Russia insists it won't invade Ukraine, but the U.S. says the signs suggest otherwise. Shelling intensifies in eastern Ukraine, and diplomatic talks from Moscow to de-escalate appear to be going nowhere. So, is war inevitable? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Mohammed Jamjoum. The U.S. has again warned that Russia could invade Ukraine at any moment. Secretary of State Antony Blinken told the United Nations Security Council that Moscow may manufacture an excuse to attack. Russia's deputy foreign minister called the allegations baseless. Beyond the war of words, fighting in eastern Ukraine is worsening. Russian-backed separatists and Ukrainian government forces accuse each other of stepping up artillery and mortar fire in the contested Donbass region. Charles Stratford has more from Pavlopil in southeastern Ukraine.
We've been speaking to people in this village. They indeed say that in the last couple of days, there has been an escalation of shelling. They were telling us that they heard shelling this morning between around 5 and 8 in the morning. It was the same yesterday. And it's been a similar kind of story along various areas of the 420-kilometre front line in the last 24 hours. The Ukrainian military this morning saying that shelling was ongoing or had continued overnight. The people you speak to, most of them do not believe that there will be any further Russian escalation. But as we've been reporting, they are exhausted. They are tired of this conflict. They have very little faith in their own governments, certainly on the Ukrainian side, to deal with this crisis. But at the same time, very little trust in what Vladimir Putin has said. So despite it being calm here today, the situation certainly remains tense.
Ukraine's defense minister says he believes the risk of a Russian invasion is low at this stage, but insists the army is prepared.
I would like to underline that we constantly face provocations, shelling, cyber attacks, dangerous maneuvers by aviation, the lowering of our mobile coverage. Our task is not to do what the Russian Federation pushes us to do. We will repel, but keep our head cool.
Around 150,000 Russian soldiers have been deployed near the Ukrainian border. Moscow says it has pulled some of them back, but the U.S. and its Western allies in NATO don't believe that. Russia's President Vladimir Putin is due to oversee nuclear military drills on Saturday. The Kremlin denies the exercises will inflame tensions. Diplomatic efforts intensified on Friday. Ukraine is the main talking point at the Munich Security Conference in Germany. The U.S. president and vice president are also holding discussions with European and NATO leaders.
You know, it's ironic that what Mr. Putin did not want to see happen was a stronger NATO on his flank. And that's exactly what he will see going forward.
All right, let's bring in our guests. In Washington, D.C., we have William Taylor. He is Vice President, Russia and Europe at the U.S. Institute of Peace and a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. From Odessa, Hannah Celeste, Director of Security Programs at the think tank Ukrainian PRISM. And in Moscow by Skype is Pavel Felgenhauer. He's an independent defense and military analyst. A very warm welcome to you all, and thanks so much for joining us today on Inside Story. William, let me start with you. From your perspective, at this stage, is war inevitable?
War is not inevitable. Mr. Putin has a decision. He can invade, in which case there will be a war, a major war in Europe, first time since World War II, or he can decide to negotiate. That option has been on the table. He's expressed some interest in this, at least in some aspects of negotiation. So he has a choice. War is not inevitable.
Pavel, the last we've heard from Russian President Putin was in a news conference a short time ago where he said that we are ready to follow negotiation track with NATO on security guarantees. What exactly does that mean?
Well, Russia has issued its position that Russia is totally unhappy with the present security arrangements in Europe and wants to rewrite them and rewrite them dramatically. Moscow's demand, several key demands, that NATO cease any further expansion, including Ukraine, but not only Ukraine. American and other Western militaries and infrastructure are withdrawn from former East European, Central European nations to the positions of 1997, and the new attack weapons are not placed anywhere near Russia's border, where Russia would not like them. That's more or less the thing. The West is not agreeing to that. That's what Moscow also says, the Russian leadership. The Western response is not adequate. And so that means there's going to be continued military and diplomatic pressure. But that means also right now, I see indications that the Russian military are beginning to step down from the present super high state of readiness. They're stepping down. It's not yet totally conclusive, but apparently, yes. So apparently, we're going to have at least some de-escalation, at least a military de-escalation, though the tension, the diplomatic tension, and actually the threats will continue.
Hannah, as you heard Pavel, then he was talking about the fact that one of the main demands from Russia is that Ukraine not ever join NATO. This has been so much a part of this crisis. I want to ask you, from your vantage point, what's the sentiment right now in Ukraine with regards to Ukraine possibly joining NATO in the future? Is this something that's important to Ukrainians? Are most of them against this idea or for this idea?
Thank you for your question. There are several things to emphasize. First of all, in 2013, Ukraine already had a status of de facto neutral state, not claiming the membership in NATO, and it didn't stop the Russian Federation to annex Crimea and to start aggression in Donbas. So the neutral status of Ukraine not joining NATO is not something that really changing the future of sovereignty of Ukraine from the Russian perspective. It just became a nice slogan to present. In terms of support, in 2013, it was just 13%. Now, the new polls being published just a few days ago, 62% of Ukrainians support Ukrainian membership in NATO. So you can imagine how the Russian aggression did completely opposite. They just raised the support among the population. Is it critical for Ukraine? We need to understand that it's not something technical. We are speaking about the choice of people, the choice of country. And Ukraine is choosing to be with the best in terms of security, in terms of values, principles, and democracy. So in this way, it's not about Ukraine joining NATO or joining European Union or any other country. It is about the sovereign choice of the state to enter those military alliances that we would like. Plus, don't forget that the statements of the Russian Federation in December was not only about Ukraine. They de facto asked that NATO would reject all those membership that happened after 1997. So it means all Eastern European countries should either demilitarize or just left the NATO if to read those proposals.
William, Russia is saying that President Vladimir Putin is going to personally oversee military drills involving strategic forces on Saturday at a time when tensions are soaring. What message is the U.S. going to take away from this?
Yes, the message that we will hear is that President Putin is willing to and continue the high crisis mode. He is trying to intimidate. President Putin is trying to intimidate President Zelensky, President Biden, NATO into giving concessions along the lines that Pavel described. And so far, President Zelensky and President Biden and NATO have not agreed at all. They have rejected these concessions. They are not intending, and they've given no indication that they want to give these concessions to President Putin. So President Putin's military buildup, his attendance at these nuclear drills are all intended to intimidate. And so far, President Zelensky and President Biden have not been intimidated.
Pavel, you said earlier that there is going to be, at least from your perspective, there is going to be de-escalation, or the de-escalation is happening. Of course, NATO has said repeatedly that there's no meaningful evidence that there is any de-escalation steps being taken right now. I want to ask you, how long can President Putin keep the Russian military in this kind of a heightened state?
I don't think that very long, but of course, the escalation, the buildup of battle readiness took over 2 months at least. And so right now, the Russian military, entire Russian military, not only around Ukraine, but in the entirety of the nation, in the Pacific, in the North Sea, in the Mediterranean, and in the nuclear deterrent, nuclear strategic forces, all are cocked and ready. Cocked and loaded, I would say. So standing down from that readiness will take also at least a month, most likely more. And that should begin now, more or less. I see early signs, and actually this exercise, strategic nuclear exercise happening tomorrow, is also an indication that there's a standing down beginning, because traditionally such exercises, when the president sort of sits together with his top military chiefs and gives orders to fire strategic intercontinental missiles, and some are actually fired, of course, without nuclear weapons, and into aiming at Russian test grounds in Kamchatka and other places of Russia, that's always the culmination and the end of a big kind of military buildup. I mean, that's a simulation that we had the buildup, we had the crisis, we had maybe a regional war. It ends up in a nuclear holocaust, which will be kind of reenacted tomorrow. And that's, and after that, it all more or less begins to de-escalate. That's the good news. The bad news is that if there won't be any meaningful and comprehensive resolution of the underlying political and security problems, somewhere in, I don't know, 6 months, 7 months, we're going to see something happening the same again, the same crisis, the same buildup, and maybe even it will be worse.
William, I saw you nodding along to some of what Pavel was saying there. It looked like you wanted to jump in, so go ahead.
Thank you. No, I agree with Pavel that if President Putin does go to negotiations, that is, if he decides not to invade Ukraine, even if he makes that decision, our view is he won't give up. He will continue to want to dominate Ukraine. He will continue to want to try to reabsorb Ukraine into the Russian world, into the Russian empire. That desire, that almost obsession with Ukraine will not go away. And so Pavel's right. The West will have to continue to support Ukraine militarily, diplomatically, financially, for a long time, so that it can proceed on its own desired direction. So as Hannah has said, Ukraine is a sovereign country, gets to decide. And if it's decided to go toward Europe, that's its decision. And the United States will continue to help Ukraine on that path.
Hannah, the Donbass region has significant Russian minority. Russia has said the people there feel more Russian, but there are some surveys that have disputed this. Would the possibility of ceding parts of those two regions, or the entirety of the regions, Donetsk and Luhansk, or perhaps allowing more Russian influence there, would that do anything to de-escalate?
Mohamed, several things. First of all, clarification. Donbass never been Russian. My family is from there, so I have all the right to speak about this. Don't mix the Russian and Russian speaking. Russian speaking just historically happened in several regions of Ukraine because of the Soviets. But it started even earlier for several prohibitions of use of Ukrainian language. However, ethnically, Donbass is quite a multi-ethnic with the dominant Ukrainian population. And before 2014, we never had any issues ethnic issues, not in Donbass, not in my city of Odessa, where I live now, that's also by Russians very often are called the Russian city. Nobody knows from where. It's more of the historical myths that Russia been very successful in bringing. However, definitely those regions were under heavy Russian information influence and political influence for quite a time, even before 2014. So that gives some difficulties there for the future. And also about de-escalation, I would like to be the same optimistic as Pavel, and trust me, I'm the first one who would like to see de-escalation, but the real situation demonstrates completely different. First of all, the intelligence services just confirmed that additional forces being brought to the border of Ukraine in the last few days. The temporary bridges been built near the rivers. Plus, the last 2 days, you have the significant violation of the ceasefire in Donbass. Just yesterday, 50 towns being shelled and even targeted kindergartens and schools, so mostly civilian places. And two-thirds of these were with the use of the weapons prohibited by the Minsk agreement. So for 5 years, they should be withdrawn very far from the contact line. So these is definitely not demonstrating the escalating. Plus, what we see in continuation for what my colleague said, that even if these big military build-up would be over, what is next? What is next we're already witnessing. First of all, it is the intense cyber attacks against Ukraine. Just for the last months, you have two huge cyber attacks against banks, against the governmental institutions in Ukraine. And it is the economic blockade or the maritime blockade. Since Sunday, we have the Northern Black Sea being blocked by the Russian military exercises. When ships, for example, cannot cross the Kerch Strait for more than 60 hours, mm-hmm. and the ports of Odessa also have difficulties and needed to reroute many of the big cargo ships coming here.
Hannah, I just want to follow up with you also and ask you, do Ukrainians largely trust what they're hearing from the government at this stage? Are they happy with how President Zelensky is navigating all of this?
Ukrainians are never happy and never trusting the government. You need to understand it. In one of your videos, the journalist said that Ukrainians doesn't trust the government. That's a little bit tricky thing, because Ukrainians never made the president, never perceived the president or the government as the gods or as the tsar. So for us, it's always the complaints about the government, because for us, that is democracy. The question is that if you see, for example, the percentage of population that trust the armed forces, it is more than 70%. The same when you speak about other agencies involved in the protecting security and defending Ukraine. That's much more important. In terms of Zelensky, we know his background. So definitely a lot of people thought that he's not ready for the significant security threats and challenges. What the practice showed, as for now, he managed more or less with the situation. Would we like to see better? Surely, mm-hmm. as any citizens, we always would like our presidents to act even better, perform even better than they're doing. But that's normal.
Pavel, what else is at play here when it comes to what President Putin wants? I mean, is this simply about Ukraine, or is there a lot more at stake?
Well, it's for Russia, it's clearly not just about Ukraine. Ukraine is just part of the big picture. Moscow is putting maximum pressure on the West, on the United States and its allies, for them to make concessions and agree to a new framework of security in Europe that will give Russia a much bigger say in what's happening in Europe. And apparently it's believed that if such a solution happens, Ukraine will just fall into Russia's lap as an additional bonus. And this heightened pressure will continue. And actually, there are more risks, really, than just simply around Ukraine. There was an incident in the Sea of Okhotsk, which Russia considers its territorial waters, and deployed a sizable naval force there, because the Sea of Okhotsk is a kind of a bastion where Russian strategic nuclear submarines go and patrol. From there, they're intended to shoot intercontinental missiles, nuclear missiles at the United States, and they should be guarded there. And there, a Russian frigate used live depth bombs against what they thought was an American intruding submarine. Apparently, no one got hit there. No one was injured, but that's what might happen. There are also reports of bust-throughs between Russian planes and American planes in the Mediterranean, where Russia deployed also an anti-carrier force. And there are three NATO carriers right now in the Mediterranean, an American one, Harry Truman, a French one, and an Italian one. And they're Russian cruisers that are intended to sink carriers. So, and there are no Ukrainians in the Mediterranean, no Ukrainians in the Sea of Ochotsk or in the Baltic. And there could be direct skirmishes between American and Russian militaries if the situation continues to be tense. Or even if there's a de-escalation, it'll get tense in 6 months. And that's already a direct Russian-American war possible. I mean, not that it's very possible, but the threat of a escalation happening somewhere through is very high, and at least it's a very dangerous situation.
William,
and it's not just Ukraine.
William, I want to take a step back and look at another aspect of the diplomacy. President Biden has been resolute for a while now in saying that the U.S. will not send troops to Ukraine, that that is not an option. Ukraine is not a NATO member, so that means there's no treaty obligation to do that. But doesn't that, in some sense, take away a key point of leverage when it comes to the U.S. negotiating with Russia about all this?
So, first of all, the United States has had troops in Ukraine as trainers in the western part of Ukraine near Lviv, Yavoriv training ground. The United States has had up to 200 at a time armed forces, military people, active duty military in Ukraine. So that's been there. They're not there now, but that's first of all. Second point on U.S. forces is. Ukrainians have not asked for NATO troops or U.S. troops to fight beside them. That is, the Ukrainian government has not asked for that. The third thing is President Biden has been very clear, and I would even say aggressive, about moving U.S. forces from the United States to NATO, to Eastern Europe, to the border with Ukraine to demonstrate commitment and to demonstrate to Mr. Putin and to the Ukrainians that we're there very much in force. We're there with military units. A couple of the units that I used to serve in when I was in the Army are there on the eastern flank of NATO. And the fourth point is, if by some reason, Pavel pointed out a couple of places where U.S. and Russian forces have already been in close contact, dangerously close contact, if that should happen, or if the Russian forces should, for some terrible reason, attack Poland or attack the Baltics, that will trigger NATO's response, and that will mean the U.S. forces will be engaged. There's absolutely no doubt. But one last point on this. Mm-hmm. This is why negotiations are so important. One of the areas that the Russians have suggested and that the Americans and NATO have agreed to is looking at ways to avoid these kinds of clashes, looking for ways to be sure that the exercises that NATO conducts or the exercises that Russia conducts are observed, are transparent, are notified in advance. That's an important part of the negotiation that can take place. Mm-hmm.
Hannah, we just have about a minute left. I want to ask you very briefly, how big are concerns in Ukraine right now about the potential humanitarian impact of an invasion?
We already have 2 million internally displaced people in Ukraine, and you've never heard about Ukrainian refugees, luckily. So considering that Ukraine is quite a big country and a lot of our local administration are preparing that in case of the open and big aggression can be additional move of the people, that can be a certain humanitarian crisis, but nothing that, for example, European Union saw because of the Syrian refugees. We are trying to accumulate as much as possible of the local forces to cope with this situation. Mm-hmm. And the strategy for the national resilience adopted last year is one of those to deal with such cases.
All right, well, we have run out of time, so we're going to have to leave the conversation there. Thank you so much to all of our guests, William Taylor, Hannah Schellest, and Pavel Felgenhauer. And thank you, too, for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. From me, Mohammed Jamjoum, and the whole team here, bye for now.